Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later in the hour, I'll talk with a student journalist from Iowa City who investigated the racial breakdown of detention and suspension rates at her high school. Her investigation uncovered a significant disparity and earned her national recognition. But first, Langston Thomas graduated from Grinnell College this spring. His final semester didn't go as planned. After campus closed, he moved back home to the Washington, D.C. area. The killing of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer was the catalyst that set off protests around the country. But for Thomas, like for so many others, this movement is also personal. His father was incarcerated, and he himself was handcuffed by police when he was only 9 years old, accused of throwing a rock at a neighbor's house. He has been at the epicenter of the protests in the nation's capital. He was there the day law enforcement fired tear gas and rubber bullets to clear the way for President Trump's notorious photo op at St. John's Church. And he is on the line with me now. Langston Thomas, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to hear your voice. And I want to start with the experiences you've been having over the last three, almost 4 weeks now. Tell me about the Black Lives Matter movement in Washington, D.C. and what the growth has been like.
Yes. Yeah, so I think there are a lot of different people who want to show support to the Black Lives Matter movement and kind of the messages that they stand for. But my experiences with the protests have been sort of out of my own desire just to go and show support. I'm not working with any organizations, not actively organizing protests. Actually, the first protest I went to, a high school friend of mine invited me to go when I got back in the area. But a lot of people have been going down in front of the White House and other locations in D.C. almost, not necessarily sporadically, but it almost seems like people are just going there and assuming that people will be there and marching and protesting. And that's been going on almost every day. So there are organizations that have come up to start handing out supplies, food, water, masks, things of that nature, but I've just seen a lot of energy and support coming from organizations that have been established, as well as people who are now fired up by these killings. They're now being brought to a lot of our attention.
Well, and you said that people are just showing up, assuming that there will be people protesting. Has that been your experience, that every time you go, there's a protest going on?
Oh, yes. Every time I go down there, there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of people. I've gone throughout this past week, and I also went the week before, a little bit the week before that. And people have always been out there, different protests going on, different groups of protests coming together to form larger protests. So, yes, things have definitely and energetic.
Now, we know that the vast majority of the protests in Washington, D.C. and really everywhere, all over the country, have been peaceful protests, although you have been there when there have been conflicts between protesters and the police. Can you tell me what that's like?
Yeah. So the first few nights that I was out there, things began nonviolently. And then started to take a turn more towards a violent direction. I would go there in the early evening, maybe around 5, 6, maybe even 7 o'clock, and people would line up where I was in front of the White House. There would be gates separating the protesters from the park police who were guarding the White House to their back. And as they kept moving closer to the divide, and as more people kind of amassed on the other side of the divide and started chanting, just the intensity kept rising. It really felt like there were citizens who were there trying to put pressure on their elected officials to really make change, not only symbolically, but systemically. And as the night started to come upon us and the sun went down, just, I guess, something about the nighttime makes things more intense. But protesters would be cheering and talking and yelling and screaming, and the park police would shoot rubber bullets or shoot little pellet bullets or would begin to throw tear gas to try to back us up or make us go home. And yes, there was definitely some violence coming from the side of the protesters. There was a lot of destruction that first weekend I was out, especially in that kind of wealthier district around the White House. There were a lot of stores being looted, windows broken, things being robbed. And that was an intense weekend. Things like that were happening around the entire country. And I know people have mixed feelings about those sorts of things, about the looting and what that does to the movement. I have my own views. But I was honored to be a part of that. I was honored to be a part of both aspects of that, there when things were nonviolent and there when things got tense enough to where people would say, hey, if you're not going to give us what we want, we're going to destroy the things that you give value to because you don't value our lives, you don't value our families, you don't value our well-being. If you won't respond to us when we're protesting in this one way, we'll have to do something that'll make you react, that'll make you really look at us and hear us. And so I was proud to be a part of all aspects of those movements. And I kept returning. That first night, I was hit with a rubber bullet and tear gassed. The following night, I was tear gassed. And then the following day, which was the Monday when Donald Trump was having the police clear the area for that photo, there was still a little bit of tear gas thrown. There were people being chased and beaten and shot. And so things have, that weekend was particularly intense. And I think the violence on one side was very much justified and the violence on the other side is obviously not justified. But we can get into more of those things later. But that was kind of just my experience with the violence of things. In terms of human violence hurting human life, that was coming from the police and the park police. The destruction of property and of some buildings and some cars, yeah, that was on the side of some of the protesters, but never anything hurting people from what I saw.
You said you got struck by a rubber bullet. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, so we were protesting. I was nearing the front line of that divide I was telling you about. And obviously people were upset. They were chanting. I was holding a sign that said, "Justice or violence, you decide." And they were asking people to leave. They were asking people to go back. They were shining these bright lights in our faces so that we couldn't see them or see where they were, kind of further back behind the main line, but they could obviously see us clearly. And as people were chanting, some people, they would grab the divide and it would shake it because it's just above your waist. And so they would shake it and grab it as if they were going to pick it up and move it back an inch or two. And whenever people did that, that's when some of the police officers would open up a gap and they would pull out their different guns and would begin shooting at people. So as I was in that front line, I was with two friends from college. And one of them got shot in the leg and the other one got shot in the arm. While we were nearing the front line. And so they actually had to leave because one of them kind of had a panic attack because, I mean, they were rubber bullets, but they hurt. And I don't know if it's true. They're supposed to be aimed at the ground to be ricocheted so they don't, you know, have as much of a dangerous impact. But we were at point blank range almost, and they were being shot in the arm and the leg. So they had to leave. They took a step back and tried to gather themselves and then called me and said, "Hey, Langston, this is a lot. We have to go home. We're sorry." So I stayed. And once they started shooting people, this was before the tear gas, people just got more and more upset. They would run away from that area because they didn't want to get hit, but then more people would come back and flood that area and would come back more intensely. And so as more people came back, more bullets were fired, and that's when I was hit in the chest, not too long after more people had come back to fill that space. And it hurt. it really stung. I had pain in my chest for a week and a half afterwards a little bit of difficulty breathing. It definitely hurt to the touch. I was lucky in that I had worn a t-shirt and then a hoodie, and then I had a little bag with straps that went across the chest. So I had a little bit of padding, but it still extremely hurt. But in that moment, I guess I was pumped up on adrenaline and the energy. And so I kind of just took the burn and just kept going with what was going on.
I want to talk about your experiences in the many, many years before you've gotten to this point. You grew up in the Maryland and the D.C. area, and I want to start with your name, Langston. You were named after the poet Langston Hughes, and that's a pretty auspicious name to give to a brand new baby. Why did your parents name you Langston?
So both of my parents loved poetry and loved literature. They would write poems to each other. They would study African-American poets. And Langston Hughes was one of their favorite poets. And I guess that's why they chose it for me. They just thought it was a wonderful name with a wonderful legacy behind it. And they wanted me to have a wonderful legacy as well, to be able to live up and maybe even surpass that. So as far as I know, that's why they gave me such a wonderful name.
Did it ever feel like pressure when you were growing up to carry that name?
I wouldn't say it was much pressure. I loved it. I like my name. I think it's unique. It's storied, and so I really appreciate that. The most difficult thing was probably having people mix up my first name and my last name, since they think I have two first names, even though I don't see it that way.
Right.
But I would say no. And actually, I grew up reciting poetry. When I was in elementary school, we had annual heritage festivals. And that's when I began memorizing various Langston Hughes poems, and I would recite them. And there was a point in 2007 or 8, I believe, where I even performed one of my father's poems at the Lincoln Theater in D.C. I performed at a few Army research laboratories. So I was definitely embracing the story and the history of Langston Hughes a little bit.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Langston Thomas. He is a recent graduate of Grinnell College, and he's been involved with the protests going on in Washington, D.C. over the last several weeks. We're talking about his experiences. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, I'll talk with a student journalist from Iowa City who investigated the racial breakdown of detention and suspension rates at her high school. Her investigation uncovered a significant disparity, and it also earned her national recognition. Right now, another recent graduate is here with us. He is a graduate from Grinnell College. And of course, we know this spring semester didn't go as planned. After the school closed, he moved back home to the Washington, D.C. area. And over the past several weeks, he's been very involved with the protests taking place. The catalyst, of course, was the killing of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer. But the protests are about so much more than that. And just before the break, we were starting to talk about your life growing up, Langston. We talked about the fact that, of course, you're named after the poet Langston Hill Hughes. But when you were very young, you were still a baby when your father was arrested for armed robbery. That was back in 1998. And he went to prison for that. So you spent many years of your childhood growing up with a father in prison. What was that like?
It was definitely difficult in a lot of ways. And I'll say that I still knew him very well. My mother and I would visit him almost every week, if not every week. And so he would write me poetry, and we would talk, and he would discipline me if there was something I did bad. So I still definitely had him in my life, but it was hard. He wasn't home for a lot of major things that happened in that time. And I didn't always want him to be home. I was always excited to see him and was excited for him to come back to us. I was jealous of the other kids who I would see around me who had what seemed like the whole family unit. And there's something lacking there in every aspect of life. You see your mother longing for her best friend to be there, and then you have all the things that you want from a father. And so it was definitely a lot, but, you know, I was always excited to know that he was coming back. And eventually he did.
He did come back, but he never really recovered from the experience of being in prison. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so from my point of view, he was amazing. He was my best friend. The things that he was struggling with, he'd never tried to show them to me when we were talking one-on-one or when we were hanging out together one-on-one. But I think there's a lot that weighs a person down after they've been in prison for almost a decade, when the reasonings for why they went to prison are kind of up in the air. And they've also had an extremely rough and difficult history with law enforcement. But then after that, coming back into, you know, the real world, having your child have issues with law enforcement, having issues yourself trying to reestablish your life and trying to find jobs as a black man who's now been involved in the prison system, having a wife who's pregnant with another child. There are just a lot of stresses and pressures, family issues and things like that that we still had to work through. So I think there was just a lot of tension and stress due to, you know, that 8-year block of time on top of, you know, the mental and psychological stress of all of the situations. And that's a lot for a person to deal with.
Yeah. And you mentioned seeing your child have trouble with law enforcement. You were only 9 years old when you were handcuffed by the police, accused of throwing a rock at a neighbor's house, a rock that you did not throw. Tell me what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was outside in Montgomery County, Maryland, playing with a white friend of mine. And he came up with the idea of throwing these sticks at a neighbor's house and then running to hide. And so that's what we did. He threw the sticks and we ran. But when the owner of the house saw us running, he chased me down and my friend got away. And so the police, they were immediately called. And when these two white officers got there, they sat me down and they asked me what happened. And, you know, I told them I didn't throw the sticks. I didn't do it. And then one of the officers, he looks at me, he crouches down, and he says, you know, don't lie to me, because we can tell if you're lying by the way your eyes are moving. So I'm going to ask you one more time. And after I gave him the answer, they tightly handcuffed me and they put me in the back of their car. They had me direct them to the apartment complex that I was living at. When we got there, they took the cuffs off and I let them past the leasing office to the elevator. We all got in together. And as we were going up to the 7th floor, one of the officers had their arm kind of under my armpit. And he looked at me and he asked, when we get upstairs, you're not going to run away, are you? And I just shook my head no. And so we got to the 7th floor. They followed me to the apartment door and they told me to unlock it. And so I did. But luckily my mom was right there in the living room. And I don't remember much of what happened after that, but thank God she was there and all the horrible ways that story could have played out. They didn't end up playing out that way.
Your father also passed away in about the same time period. He fell from the 7th floor of that building, and you believe that he took his own life. I don't want to ask you questions about that. I know that that's a very painful part of your history. But as you were growing and you were really taking refuge in school, tell me about how your academic studies gave you a place to channel your energy.
Yeah, so I was always intrigued by my work, by my classes, by just any activity that would really force me to really use my brain to kind of solve a puzzle or solve a problem. So I did very well in school when I was in elementary school, and I loved math in particular. So when I would get home from school, my mom, she would be like, all right, no TV, you know, go do your homework. Sometimes she would help me. I would eventually study with my friends, and we would help each other. And so it was always something that I could do by myself. I could do with other people. I can find enjoyment out of it. And it made me feel good to be learning things. And so I excelled even, you know, during this really rough, horrible time. But after that, after I finished elementary school, we moved from Montgomery Village, Maryland, to Rockville, Maryland, which is where I went to middle school and high school. And that is when I really first began to encounter racist teachers who I felt like were actively working against my success. And so that's when my love of math really began to start to dwindle, especially in sixth grade, with my first math teacher that I had, who vowed to not answer questions that I had and wouldn't let me come in for extra help during lunch or before or after school when other kids could. And she just actively didn't want to teach me. And eventually, I had to muster up the confidence to tell my mother that I felt like there was this person who was supposed to be helping me, who was paid to help me, who was actually doing the opposite. And eventually I was able to switch classes, but switching in the middle of the school year, after dealing with that and having her still be there and still teach other kids and treat other kids just like a teacher should treat other kids, but then they don't treat me the same way. Just dealing with all of that and still trying to move forward, it's a lot. And it's difficult to balance all of those things as a student, as a young student, who's, you know, just beginning to have all these, you know, changes, who's in middle school. And on top of being a student, you also have to deal with all of that. And so middle school and high school were very difficult in a lot of ways. And a lot of those issues from those two areas, obviously, they affect a lot of the other things that happen, your social relationships, the way that you interact with another and deal with other teachers, the way that you deal with yourself. And so I still, despite all those things, tried to work very hard. I started to develop more of an interest in history, and social studies, and political science. As I began to experience more things and question more things and see all these weird interactions that I didn't understand. So that's kind of where my interest in politics developed.
I'm talking with Langston Thomas. He graduated from Grinnell College this spring in political science, and he grew up in the Maryland area. And Langston, you earned a full ride scholarship to Grinnell College. You came to Iowa, sight unseen, which must have been quite the culture shock in many ways. But you have said that really it was in college that you learned about systemic racism. And of course, as we've heard repeatedly, read repeatedly in the last several weeks, this is not something that is taught in our schools. It's something that is a new concept to a lot of people every day. You had been living systemic racism your whole life. When you really started to learn about it, tell me what that was like.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. I began living it well before I was ever able to put a name to it or to put a history behind it. And so for a long time, I was just dealing with these things and wondering why they're happening to me and the people I love. Why aren't they happening to my friends and other people I see? Well, you know, is this just chance? Is this just God? Is this just why? What is going on? And once I got to my school, my college, I was able to start taking classes that began to paint this larger picture for me and began to show me that, no, a lot of these things that are happening aren't because of random chance, but there's actually a history of systems that have been constructed to benefit certain people and to hurt other people. And these are the ways that that's happened. And this is how they've developed and manifested over time to create the situation that you're in and that people like you are in and people who aren't like you are in. And if I'm being honest, learning about those things, it's infuriating, it's depressing, it's angering, it's not fun, because you're learning about how messed up the world and the country is. And the more you learn, the more you realize that a lot of really messed up things happen. And the manifestations of those things are happening right now. You can see them. You can understand why they are playing out the way they're playing out. And the issues are so complicated and intertwined, it almost makes you feel like there's no real way from within this system to change it. It almost seems like the system was built to not be changed. So yes, right now the major discussion is with the criminal justice system and police. But when you look at how the issues with the criminal justice system are tied with the healthcare system, the education system, economic systems and social systems, and just the ways that we think about and interact with one another, it's almost cognitive even. When you begin to learn how ingrained and socialized all these issues are and institutionalized, it's like, wow, what? How did this happen? Is this really our country? Is this really a democracy? How can we ever get to a place where all people can really live out the American dream? Is that even possible? And so it has been extremely intriguing, but disheartening to study these things and begin to learn about these things, especially as a Black person. But one thing that my intro sociology prof told me years ago, he was that before you can fix a car, you have to learn all the different ways that it's broken down. You got to understand the whole car. And so that's kind of what I am planning on doing. I'm planning on continuing to learn about how deep and interconnected all these issues are. And then beyond that, try to develop a way to actually bring about genuine, profound systemic change that we haven't seen before in this country ever. And so that's kind of the mission that I've been on. And then I continue to be on.
Small mission. It's you were planning on going to the Peace Corps in the fall. You're in this moment that so many others are in of so much uncertainty. Do you feel like you have been changed by your experiences at these protests and by what's been going on in the last month?
I'd have to say, no, I don't feel particularly changed. The killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Rashad Brooks and all these other people, they're horrible and they're disgusting. And when you see them on tape, it almost makes you want to throw up. But they've been going on for so long. And there are so many other names and stories that aren't always as published and publicized. So I know about these things happening. And I know they're going to continue to happen. And I, like I said, I've studied the history of these issues and social movements. And so I've seen protests before. I know how protests have played out before. And I know kind of the patterns that they've taken in the past when they result from something like this. I want this to be the perfect storm. I want this to be the moment where we do begin to see some real changes. And some would argue that we have. But honestly, I see a lot of symbolic changes that are putting a Band-Aid on a really deep and longstanding wound. So I don't feel particularly changed. It is nice when you're out there and you are connecting with people, and you feel a sense of community, and you're like, wow, this feels like it could be different, but then I come back, I step away from, you know, the immediate experience and think about what I've studied and what I've seen. And it kind of just brings you back to reality a little bit. So that's sort of where I am focusing on, yes, how to still participate and show my support and be there in case this method of change does produce something. But on the other hand, I'm also understanding that that method really hasn't produced things in the past and that I need to figure out how to do something different so that we can get a different result.
Langston Thomas, we are out of time, but thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Langston Thomas, a recent graduate from Grinnell College. He studied political science. We were talking about his experiences growing up in Maryland, but also over the past few weeks being involved in the Black Lives Matter protests in Washington, D.C. Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with an enterprising student journalist. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.